Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me at the roundtable today is Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Always great to be here.
Haley B. Miller, political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome back.
Happy Monday.
And making his debut on the roundtable is Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for Hannah News Service. Welcome, Noah.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Heck of a week to start. A quick note before we get started. We expect the U.S. Supreme Court to release its decision today on whether former President Donald Trump can be prosecuted for crimes he allegedly committed while in office. WOSU is going to interrupt the roundtable to take national coverage when the presidential immunity case comes down. Until then, let's talk about politics. The biggest news of last week was, of course, the presidential debate between Trump and Joe Biden. The debate did not go well for President Biden. Calls for him to drop out of the race and let Democrats nominate somebody else began before the debate even ended. Karen, what has been the reaction here in Ohio?
Well, it's almost certain. I can't think of a circumstance where Donald Trump doesn't win Ohio. So the reaction has been not from elected officials, though. In fairness, reporters did try to get Governor Mike DeWine to react to the debate at the Capitol Bill signing, and he would not go there. I think the reaction has been among Ohio Democrats has been similar to what you've heard on the national scale. But also, I think we're starting to see a backtracking or a move in a different direction to say, OK, it was a bad night. It was a bad debate. But Democrats are now talking about how it was a bad debate for Trump and how there's serious things that he did wrong that people should be looking at and pointing to the lies that he told and things like that. So I think that's an interesting kind of pivot from what we saw on debate night and the immediate reaction, which for a lot of the commentators was just shock.
Yeah, former Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley tweeted, "Governors Whitmer, Shapiro, Beshear, and Polis, your country needs you." So not an explicit call to drop out, Haley, but I mean, that was sort of like, hey, we would like a Democratic governor to maybe step up here.
Yeah, that was definitely the message there. And it was mixed from other Democrats. You know, my colleagues talked to some state representatives last week. House Minority Leader Allison Russo said, "I deal in realities," and she's really not convinced that there's a serious likelihood that Biden's going to be replaced. State Senator Bill DeMora is a delegate really involved with the DNC, and he is, you know, still urging his fellow delegates to support President Biden. So definitely a mixed bag. I do think what we're hearing publicly from Democrats, by and large, has been very different from what we're hearing privately. Or, you know, you see a lot of reporting over the weekend that had unnamed sources so they could speak a little bit more candidly. So I think Democrats who are concerned are a little afraid to say the quiet part out loud.
And Noah, this ultimately comes down to whether President Biden wants to drop out, because he's got all the delegates. And when he goes to the convention, they will have to vote for him unless he releases them. But, you know, I want to, speaking of that convention, Secretary of State Frank LaRose took a little bit of swipe also.
Yeah, he sort of, you know, there was a big to do earlier this spring about how they were going to get the president on the ballot because some statutory deadlines were going to come before the conventions. And there was a lot of sound and fury about that for a while. And he made a little gratuitous jab at the president's party and said, "Oh, are you still really excited about having that nominating convention?" So
yeah, you still want to have that virtual convention to get him on early. Yeah, we'll have to kind of wait and see. Ultimately, though, it seems like it's going to be Biden's decision whether or not he drops out, and that there is really no path to push him out if he does not want to go.
Yeah, I think he has to be the one that drops out because he's got the delegates, like Haley said, and he would have to release them to someone else. And I know there was a whole question about the ballot deadline in Ohio, but that special session moved that deadline from 90 days to 65 days. So that's not really a factor here. It's just a question of whether there are people close to Biden who can convince him to drop out or whether the party even wants that. I think, like I said, we're starting to see a different approach now where people in the party are saying this was a not the best night, but look at what Trump did. Look at it, how he performed. And that is what we have to fight against.
You know, though, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. Or yeah. At least that's what people. So, yes, there was a lot of questions about whether former President Donald Trump was honest in the debate, whether he shared a number of pieces of misinformation.
Are there questions about this? I mean, I think it was pretty clear. And that was actually one of the things, as somebody who's moderated debates before, I was really surprised that there wasn't really any attempt at fact checking. And that just really, the way that Trump said the lies that he said in a very confident way, while Biden looked older and feeble and just his voice was low. You could hardly hear him sometimes. The contrast was tremendous, but the actual content, yes, Biden said a couple of factual inaccuracies too, but the inaccuracies on the Trump side were dramatically higher.
I was struck by, there was one point where Donald Trump asked to respond to something Joe Biden said, and I think it was Jake Tapper said, well, I'm going to ask my next question about this topic, but then you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. And they did note a couple
of
times.
Which, I mean, happens in any political interview.
They did note a couple of times that you didn't answer the question, but there was no attempt to say, I mean, Trump said some just really like horrifying things about abortion, for instance, and there was no attempt to say, that's not true, that's not happening, what you're saying is not correct. There was nothing on that other than I think Biden might have reacted at some point to some of that. But
yeah,
the Biden moderator certainly never stepped in and said, wait a minute, that's not true. We need to tell the audience that that's not happening.
Yeah, Biden really pushed back pretty hard on the idea of abortion after birth, which was a very bizarre claim.
But I think that Trump is getting a lot of his confidence from the rallies and the things that he's saying in those. And that's the exaggerations have been building through these rallies because he certainly gets energy back from the audience. And this is definitely, it's just simply not true, of course. And there's no evidence anywhere of it. But it was really kind of a horrible claim that I think that there are some conspiracy theorists out there who want to push that.
While we're on the subject of national politics, the Republican National Convention starts July 15th, so just around the corner. And Ohio's own Senator J.D. Vance remains on the short list to be Trump's vice president. Haley Vance said last week he'd be disappointed if he wasn't selected, which surprised me because you don't normally express that publicly.
Yeah, it was a rare candid moment for him. I think he's been watching what he says throughout this entire debate conversation about the VP because he ultimately knows it's Trump's decision, but I think he also knows where he sits on the list at this point. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I get the sense it's between him and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum at this point, although knowing Trump, he could pull an entirely different rabbit out of the hat. So I guess we'll see what happens. But you know, even if Vance isn't the VP nominee, I think we'll expect him to play a very active role in Trump's campaign regardless. And, you know, I think there's a very real possibility that if Trump wins in November, Vance gets promoted to a different job, a cabinet position or something like that. I think either way you slice it, it's possible that his days as Ohio senator are numbered.
The biggest news of Ohio's politics last week was the massive $6.2 billion spending package. Noah, the governor signed the capital budget last week, but for a while there this spring, it looked like we might not have a deal at all.
Yeah, the House and the Senate were at odds for a while, particularly over this what's called the one-time strategic community investment
fund. The
super-duper fund, the OTSCIF, because everything has an acronym in state government. Lawmakers set aside this $700 million or so dollar pool in the operating budget and said, we'll get back to you on how we're going to spend it. The House basically took half of it and said, this is how we want to spend it back in, oh, say, February. And the Senate said, well, that's not really how we agreed to do this. They kind of talked past each other with competing versions of appropriations bills that had other things in them, like state park money and school construction money, and they just then brought it down to the wire right before leaving for summer break to wrap it up with the big package.
Yeah, it's the largest package ever, right? This $6.2 billion when you factor in all the extra spending.
Well, and a lot of that is the $717 million that he's talking about, which it's been said several times that that is one-time money. So it's not something that we should expect going down the road, I guess, especially since tax collections have been coming in lower than estimates. Happy fiscal new year, by the way, to all of you.
Oh, yes. Thank you. So we'll have to wait and see what next, well, actually, it'll be 2 years till we do this all over again. But the spending bill doled out money for hundreds of local construction projects for schools, jails, libraries, even playgrounds. Here's House Finance Chair Jay Edwards talking about one particular kind of project.
I learned one big thing throughout this process. I never knew how popular the sport pickleball was. I never seen as many pickleball courts be put into the community projects.
And in particular, the pickleball courts were in more rural parts of the state. So this is money, Haley, that goes all over the state for all kinds of projects.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously the bigger counties like Hamilton and Franklin got a lot of the big bucks. Hamilton County in particular actually cleaned up pretty well this time. But, you know, as you said, this goes all over the state, and it's a really good opportunity for lawmakers to say they brought XYZ project to the finish line. They were able to get state funding for it. So it's a bill that usually makes everyone happy at the end of the day, and everyone likes better roads and better school buildings. So
better parks and playgrounds. But not everybody was happy with the Capitol bill. Noah, Republican Senator Niraj Antani was the lone vote against the Capitol bill in the Ohio Senate. Did he say why?
Yeah, he talked about kind of from a fiscal conservative perspective, not wanting to spend all that money. There's this mechanism that they actually just sort of got rid of where you can, if you have a lot of extra money left over at the end of an operating budget, you can return it to the taxpayers in
a refund check.
In a one time. And they typically shy away from doing that. And they actually decided instead this time to create an expanded sales tax holiday with that excess revenue. But he was under the impression that they should just have not have spent the money and been a little more fiscally conservative.
And I talked to Senate Finance Committee Chair Matt Dolan about the budget for our TV show, The State of Ohio, this week, and noted that indeed he had the one vote from a Republican senator against it. And he said, and this is a quote from Dolan, "Senator Antani can say whatever he wants, but he really hasn't earned my respect as a public servant. So what he said is all politics." So that I thought that was pretty direct, but I think that
no love lost there.
Yeah, and there were what, four or five Republicans in the House that also voted against it. But yeah, I mean, this is one of those bills that was expected to go through, and virtually everyone's happy. Not all, apparently, though.
So lawmakers are now off on their summer break, and the big question is, when are they going to return? They technically have some voting sessions in the fall, but is anything really going to get done before the November 2024 election?
No.
Here we go.
The Senate came out with its schedule just Friday, I think, and they officially said they will return the week after the November election, and they will basically meet until the week before Christmas, leaving out the week of Thanksgiving. And the House has not released its second half schedule. I wouldn't expect it to be much different. I asked the Speaker on the last night of session, do you think of anything that's really going to bring you back before? And he said if there's some dramatic breakthrough on one of these public policy issues that they're wrestling with, maybe. But it's been pretty rare that they would come back in an election year before November.
So nothing until lame duck.
Yeah, and it's going to be a fun lame duck.
Depends on your definition of fun.
That's the word we want to use. I mean, there's just so much that's still on the table being negotiated that Noah referenced. There's been a lot of talk about changing the marijuana law that's going nowhere. There's a stalemate between the House and Senate over higher education reform. And, you know, this has been a very unproductive legislative session, as has been documented and various reports and things like that, and just by witnessing it, I think. So it's possible lame duck will have the same tenor to it, or they'll just get ram through everything that they haven't done over the last year and a half.
And on the higher education bill, Senate Bill 83, before session started last week, its sponsor, Republican Senator Jerry Serino, came out and told reporters it's not going to be on the House floor. And it has passed a House committee. And he said that he was not going to meet with Speaker Jason Stevens over the summer to make any changes to it. And that basically implying that either it's going to pass in lame duck or he's going to bring it back next year. And he says if he brings it back next time, it will not have some of the changes that he's made. For instance, he dropped a ban on faculty strikes. So I wouldn't anticipate a breakthrough on that one. But yeah, there could be other ones that we could see some movement on. But I expect we have a break till. Break from the legislature till after the election. Now we can use that time to cover the election.
I would also add, I think Senator Serino is maybe putting his chips on the possibility of a Speaker Matt Huffman next year, depending how the fight for the gavel shakes out, because Huffman is very pro Senate Bill 83, and it wouldn't have any issues getting through the Senate with the new Senate president in place. So I think that's in Serino's mind as well.
Yeah, no, I think in the press conference that Senator Jerry Serino had when he said he was going to wait for a more favorable House environment, that was the, like, I'm waiting to see if Huffman's speaker sentence.
And he acknowledged that as much. We got the follow-up question, are you talking about a new speaker? Well, yes, of course. That's one possibility.
Yeah, I spoke to a Democrat a couple weeks ago who was like, and I asked point blank, you know, this version of Senate Bill 83 doesn't have the provision that would ban professors from striking. It allowed certain kinds of mandatory DEI training in certain circumstances. It took out, you know, it softened some of the language about China and relationships with Chinese universities. Like, there were a lot, there's been dozens of changes to this massive bill. And I was like, you know, are you, by blocking it from coming to the floor in the House, are you taking a gamble that what you're going to get in 2025 is much worse in terms of their opinion on the legislation? And he was like, I can't let something bad go because something worse might come along. So I think that's kind of the difficult position they're in.
Senator Serino had a pretty sweeping higher ed bill in the prior General Assembly, and it was negotiated to a much narrower package over the course
that's
of,
kind of, how it goes.
Of the session. So, you know. That's the legislative process.
Coming up, we're talking about the controversial bathroom bill that the legislature passed before heading out on its summer break. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Hannah News Service reporter and editor Noah Blundo, political reporter Haley B. Miller of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Just a reminder, if you're just tuning in, we expect the U.S. Supreme Court to release its decision today on whether former President Donald Trump can be prosecuted for certain crimes he allegedly committed while president. WOSU is going to interrupt our coverage to take the National News Network when the Trump immunity case comes down. The legislature break for the summer and potentially before they break until after the November 2024 election. Around 10:30 p.m., about 12 hours into this marathon of a legislative session, Republicans tacked on an amendment to a bill about our state's college credit program. The amendment would ban transgender students from using school bathrooms that align with their gender identity. Here's Republican sponsor Adam Byrd talking about it on Wednesday night.
And this bill would keep boys in the boys' restroom and girls in the girls' restroom. Now, you ask why? Why do we bring a bill like this? The reason why we bring a bill like this is because I have constituents who are asking for their young people to be protected in those facilities. Secondly, we bring an amendment like this because superintendents, school superintendents from around the state are coming to me and saying, Representative Byrd, we need clarity. We need help. There are some schools in the state of Ohio that are allowing allowing multiple people into the restroom, and then they get in trouble with their school board, with their community. And then the opposite of that happens as well. And so superintendents and school boards, they need clarity on this issue. We want to protect women and girls from assault, from intimidation.
House Minority Leader Allison Russo wasn't having Byrd's arguments and challenged the idea that this is something school districts actually want.
No surprise, in the dark of night, when most people have gone home and they are not paying attention, we are passing the worst of the worst types of bills that this body has become notorious for passing. We are sitting in a state right now, I was just reading an article, we have school districts in this state who cannot now afford bus services. We have school districts in this state who are struggling to hire teachers, and they have to consolidate classrooms. We have schools in this state right now who cannot afford the services that they need in the classrooms, like mental health services and support services, to wrap around to make sure that our students are successful. 1 in 5 children in this state lives in poverty and doesn't know where their next meal is going to come from, and they experience food insecurity, many in your district. And this is what we're spending our time and energy on? I'm sorry, but don't tell me your school districts are coming to you begging for this. Baloney. We talk and hear from school districts all the time. All of you do. They are not talking about bathrooms. They want to fill teacher positions. They want help affording bus services. They want help building and making sure that we're creating good, safe learning environments for our children in this state. This is not their priority. This is red meat. This doesn't solve any problem at all. I am a parent. I have 3 kids in school right now. No one is talking about this.
So, Haley, we were going to talk about that, but I want to interrupt and just say quickly that the U.S. Supreme Court holds that former president, it does actually, the decision in whether U.S. Bleh, I am getting twisted up on my words. The U.S. Supreme Court decision on whether former President Donald Trump does in fact have immunity from certain acts allegedly committed while in office has just come down. We are waiting to see what the actual decision is, but I wanted to quickly flag that for everyone. But to circle back to what House Minority Leader Allison Russo said, this bathroom bill has passed the House. It passed with only Republicans and no Democratic support. Haley, you were there when this vote came down. So what was it like when it, I mean, this was like 10:30, 11 o'clock-ish at night?
Yeah, a late night vote from the from the House, one of the last things they did. And it was kind of interesting that they decided to do this because the Senate had already adjourned for the day. So this isn't getting any concurrence vote, if it does at all, until November, December, like we discussed. They're not coming back until then. But tensions were definitely running high. Democrats were frustrated that, again, the House was taking a vote late at night when a lot of people aren't tuned in on a really controversial issue. They've done this before with other LGBTQ-related legislation. So a lot of frustration, but this has been a priority for Republicans for a while, and I guess folks in the House wanted to make that clear before they broke for the summer.
Circling back to the presidential immunity case, which has just come down from the U.S. Supreme Court, it appears to be a 6-3 decision, and it's kind of a not only a split decision on the court, but it's a split decision regarding immunity. It appears to have held that a president would have absolute immunity for constitutional duties in office. So absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for actions within his conclusive and preclusive constitutional authority. However, it says there is no immunity for unofficial acts. And this is what Justice Amy Coney Barrett was really talking about when they had oral arguments. It was Trump acting as president in this situation, or was he acting as someone trying to become president, right? Was he the office holder or the office seeker? So an attempt to, say, overturn the 2020 election could be an action taken by an office seeker and not an office holder. So while a president would have immunity for official acts, former President Donald Trump might not have immunity from acts taken in his private capacity to, say, change the results of an election, if that makes sense.
Well, I think from what I'm reading here, you know, this isn't over because they're remanding now to the lower court to puzzle this out sort of over again within
about
the
whether
confines.
It was a public act, and that's really where it's going to come down to, because one of the things that Amy Coney Barrett really talked about and I found really interesting during oral arguments was this idea, the office holder versus the office seeker. And so it sounds like the court is saying the office seeker does not have immunity, even if they are currently the office holder, if that makes sense.
I'm still wrapping my head around it. In some ways, it feels like, I don't know if it's harsh to say they're punting the thrust of the question, but they're drawing a line here and asking the lower courts to figure that out. They're not, you know, going to weigh in any further clearly on what does unofficial look like, what does official look like, what does office seeker versus office holder look like. So I think in a lot of ways, we're not going to know anytime soon if this is actually a win for Trump or not.
Yeah, the case, which was brought by the former president, stems from 4 charges that he's facing in the District of Columbia. They're 4 federal charges dealing with conspiracy to commit obstruction, it basically deals with what happened on January 6th. So there are 4 different charges centering around January 6th. 2 of those, the question was, dealt with the case that came down on Friday, and that was essentially this obstructing of an official proceeding. And they ruled in that situation that you have to attempt to destroy the documents, that if you bust into the House chamber and try to disrupt the count that would finalize an election and you didn't grab for documents, that doesn't count as obstruction. That was a split decision. But in this situation, it will come down to, I think, whether they think this was an official act of a president or the act of a candidate trying to become president. But either way, Karen, I kind of feel like Trump has already won something, because this delay, this ruling, sending it back to the trial court, what we're essentially doing is saying that there won't be an actual trial on the merits of the January 6th case until after the November election.
Yeah, and I think that was expected. I mean, I think the expectation was that the only trial that we were going to see the end of was the one in New York with the 34 felony convictions. It's interesting, of course, to note that it looks like it's 3 liberals on the court, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, who are dissenting. So it's really an ideologically split court on this issue. But yeah, it does, I think, and with a lot of these court things, you know, there's always the hope that when you take it to court, there'll be a resolution and there will be a decision. But we've seen it, like, even in Ohio with, for instance, the 6-week abortion ban, where there was a decision, it sent it down to the other court, and we're still waiting on the lower court to issue that decision. So it's kind of anticlimactic here, but it's definitely, for people who were hoping to see a Donald Trump trial on this happen before the election, it's not good news.
The opinion, you know, specifically says here, close to the end of the syllabus, that they're not going to focus on present exigencies. You know, what's going on day to day in the presidential campaign is not their concern. They say they're trying to think about some long-lasting separation of powers arguments.
Yeah, in the dissenting opinion by Kagan, Jackson, and Sotomayor, what I find really interesting, and we're just seeing snippets of it come down. So it says, never in the history of our republic has a president had reason to believe he would be immune from criminal persecution if he used the trappings of his office to violate criminal law. Moving forward, however, all former presidents will be cloaked in such immunity. So giving absolute immunity to crimes committed in office, I do wonder, and I'm not going to ask you guys to pontificate on this since you are not constitutional scholars, if it gets to the question of a president murdering his political enemies, can he be prosecuted for that?
Wow.
I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is right now. Like, logically, I would think, yes, of course, we don't want the president to kill his enemies.
Well, yeah. But, no, these are, and I guess this is what the analysts are for. This is what the pundits and people who can read these decisions very, very quickly and tell you what they think that means. I think that's, I know NPR had planned on doing something on this, but certainly
it's going
to be a lot of reaction to this.
We will be going to NPR national coverage in just a few minutes. They are, I assume, reading it just as quickly as we are trying to read it and trying to give you analysis. So as soon as NPR national is ready, we will turn over the control of the car to them and let them take it from there. So I think we're going to go ahead and take a quick break while we wait for NPR National to get together on the Trump immunity case coming up. You may hear back from us, or you may hear from someone else. That's on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
Kids Days to register for this free event. Major funding for WOSU's Second Saturday Kids Days is provided by the DeMarco family.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us this hour is Hannah News Service reporter and editor Noah Blundo, political reporter Haley B. Miller of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. If you're just tuning in, the U.S. Supreme Court has released its decision today on whether former President Donald Trump can be prosecuted for crimes he allegedly committed while president. NPR National will be coming with coverage explaining the decision in just a few minutes. But for now, I want to talk a little bit about local news, because the campaign to put redistricting on our ballot again this November just dropped off 731,000 signatures to the Secretary of State's office, Karen.
Yeah, and those of us, we are the only three reporters, the only three State House reporters not there right now, even though our bureaus are all there.
I appreciate you all very much.
But I mean, this is a big deal because this has been talked about for months now. They've got way more signatures than they need. They need, 413, thousand-ish yes. valid signatures. They're submitting 731,306. And as I understand it, they've vetted a lot of these. So they're going to get the number that they need to make the November ballot, which means the campaign for and against what will be issue one is really kind of underway.
They've exceeded what the Abortion and Reproductive Rights Amendment campaign group submitted to successfully get their issue on the ballot last year. So as a marker, I mean, you know, you're going to get some signatures are going to get burned for being invalid, people not having their registrations up to date. But they've got a lot of wiggle room, it appears.
And they didn't beat Senate Bill 5 back in
10?
Yeah. I can't even remember
11.
What year.
11.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. And that was a record. That was over a million signatures. But still, this is, like Noah said, a significant, a much more significant number than they need. And there's a rally planned for afterwards. They just submitted their signatures to the Secretary of State's office, I don't know, 5-10 minutes ago.
And it'll take about a week or so, right? Haley, it takes some time for them to go through the signatures and declare whether or not it's made the ballot.
Yeah. But I think we can feel pretty confident about their chances, and you know, it'll be interesting to see where the campaign goes from here. There are a lot of people in the legislature who do not want this on the ballot, who do not want it to pass, but I think redistricting reform is a thing that appeals generally to voters, and particularly for those who paid attention to the last redistricting cycle, which was a mess, to put it mildly. So I think
Speaking of Supreme Courts, it went to the Ohio Supreme Court multiple times.
Seven times. And all seven, it was those maps were deemed unconstitutionally gerrymandered. I think it's interesting to note that one of the voices that you'll hear most strongly on this is going to be Senate President Matt Huffman, who we've talked about as likely
trying to be House Speaker.
Yes. And he was one of the original architects of the system that's in place right now. And in 2015 and 2018, when voters approved it for congressional and legislative redistricting. So you're going to hear a lot from him and from other Republicans.
That was Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. I want to say thank you, because we're going to be switching to NPR coverage of the Trump immunity case. So thank you, Karen.
Great to be here.
Thanks to Noah Blundo, reporter and editor of Hannah News Service.
Thank you.
Very strange debut on all sides, but thank you. And political reporter Haley B. Miller of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Thanks for coming out.
Of course.
We're now turning you over to NPR National for coverage of the Trump immunity decision from the U.S. Supreme Court.